Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I've been singing all day, singing all night, singing cause I got this feeling and I know.
Thanks for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I'm so pleased to be joined today by Joe Sanson, the Director of Monitoring and Evaluation for an organization called Trickle Up, which empowers women around the world who are living on less than $1.25 per day to begin taking the first steps out of extreme poverty. It's a fascinating and seemingly pretty daunting line of work, so we'll jump right in. Joe, thanks so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you, Daniel. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So to start out, will you tell us maybe a little more elegantly than I just did what Trickle Up does as an organization?
Sure, you did a pretty good job, but we work with some of the poorest households and the poorest women around the world to help them to develop new livelihood activities, so that means new businesses, agriculture, and so on, to help them leave poverty. And we do this, you know, through a whole sort of a fairly holistic approach involving seed capital grants, savings groups, and a lot of training and support to make sure we really are reaching the poorest.
So I want to get into those sort of specific tools that you use in a minute. But could you tell us what are the parts of the world that you're working in, and how do you identify the populations that most need the kind of interventions that you're providing?
Sure, we work in West Africa, Central America, and India, and we identify the poorest regions in the country where we work using government and other data and statistics, and then identify the poorest villages in those regions. Then we work with community members to identify all the households in the community, and after that we facilitate an exercise in which the communities themselves determine who is poorer than who, taking into account any local specific manifestations of poverty. And at that point we work with local partner organizations in each of these regions where we work, and our staff go around and verify the poverty status of these poorest people who have been identified in the community using household surveys, as well as checking that there aren't any people that are so poor and marginalized that they didn't even make it into the community's list.
So that sounds like quite a process just to identify the people that you should be working with. How long does that take? How much staff on the ground does that take to even begin to sort of see the kinds of people that you want to be helping?
Sure, it's a couple of days in each community.
Oh, wow.
But it's really important because it means that then the selection process is transparent and it builds community buy-in and support for the project, so everybody really understands the process. And through that process, it can also help build community awareness about who in the community really is marginalized and needs that help. But for us, it's also really important because it enables us to target people who are usually not integrated into development programs because they're generally very marginalized and their voices aren't heard within the community. And so they often remain invisible when organizations come in.
How are you received by the communities that you come in to work with? You know, like you said, you're sort of targeting the poorest of the poor within individual communities. So are there people that are significantly better off in those communities than the people you're working with? And are the ones who you do end up working with very receptive to your help, or are they standoffish? How does it work?
Right. It's an interesting question. There often is a lot of mistrust at first.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's often the case, and particularly with the poorest people. There's a lot of scams out there. There's a lot of you know, people who, you know, really have received nothing in their lives. So they think, you know, what is this about? So there is, so that rapport building, that building trust is a really important part of it. And because we are working with the poorest people in the communities, that means that some people who are a little bit better off are not directly benefiting from the project. So that, again, is why it's really important they're involved in the process. But we do find, you know, after we've been working there for a while, you know, whenever we come back to these communities, you know, everybody in the community really receives us very well because, you know, a lot of the benefits of the program do end up helping other people in the community as well, whether it's through training or investment and so on. You know, sometimes in, like in West Africa, when we've gone to visit and monitoring visits, the entire community comes out to visit us. It's actually quite embarrassing.
So it actually trickles up, true to the name of your organization. It reaches everyone. Can you just talk a little bit about, you know, maybe this is an obvious question, but why do you choose to work with, you know, the very poorest of the poor? I mean, I guess there's some sort of moral responsibility to help the neediest people, but, you know, why the very poorest? What does that mean? And what are the particular, I imagine there's a whole set of particular challenges that come with people who are at the very bottom of the poverty scale, as opposed to a little bit higher up. How does that play out? What are the hard parts about working with this particular population?
Sure. Yeah, well, the reasons we do work with this, as you say, is partly because, you know, these are the people who are in most need. But the other part, as you also do allude to, is because they are the hardest people to work with, which means that even though they're the ones in most need, they're the ones who often don't reap the benefits of so many development programs. You know, that's particularly true for things like microfinance, where there's a fair bit of evidence that it can be quite good for people, you know, who are at a certain level, you know, of poverty, but not in extreme poverty, because they are able to take advantage of loans and put them to good use. Whereas the people we work with really are not, you know, not in that position to be able to take on those risks. They often aren't even aware of services that are available to them. So, I mean, it is a lot harder to work with this population, and that's exactly the reason why we're doing it, because, you know, it means that so many other organizations are not.
And what about if you sort of take a broad view of it? Obviously, it's harder to work with this particular population, but, you know, in terms of doing the greatest amount of good overall, are the rewards greater? Is there some way to, obviously, if you can help individuals, no matter what, it's a good thing, but are there sort of larger scale ways of measuring, you know, if helping the poorest of the poor sort of benefits more people than helping people who are a little bit more well off?
Right. Well, I think I'd start off by answering that question in terms of how we actually understand benefits.
Yeah.
If you are moving somebody who, you know, is sort of moderately poor, so maybe they have two meals a day. I mean, that's pretty poor still. You know, everybody wants to have more than two, but they're poor.
Right.
And you move them to three meals a day. That's obviously a big improvement to their lives. But if you're moving somebody who's eating one meal a day, which means they're really chronically malnourished, to two meals a day, which means, okay, it's not quite enough, but they're actually, you know, surviving, you know, relatively decently, I would say that that's an order of magnitude, the improvement in their lives, which is far greater. In terms of other benefits, I mean, I think it's probably important to point out that, you know, one of the really important part of our work is really directly reaching and working with these very, very poor households. But what we're also trying to do is to, you know, provide an evidence base and a model for others, including, you know, government programs and so on, so that they can better understand this population and ensure that their programs, you know, their social protection programs or whatever, are actually meeting the needs of this population as well. So there we see there's a bit of sort of leveraging what we're doing to have that impact.
So I wanna try to give as much context as possible for sort of the areas that you're working and the people that you're working with. I mentioned before the $1.25 per day sort of marker of the people that you're working with. I'm wondering if there's any way to sort of paint a picture of what that means. What does it look like in practice when you're on the ground with these people? You know, how many people are living in that level of poverty? You know, what are the conditions that create that kind of poverty? Any context that we could provide would be great, because it seems like it's easy to put a number on it, but I certainly don't have any idea what that actually looks like.
Sure, no, most people don't. Well, There is an estimated 1.2 billion people who are living in extreme poverty, as defined as being below $1.25 a day. And it's probably worth pointing out that this is at purchasing power parity. So I often find people say, oh, but $1.25, you know, can't you get you anything in New York, but you go to India, it can get you a lot more.
Sure.
But that's actually taking into account the different purchasing power. So it's actually adjusted for these different countries. So living at that level means that people are struggling to meet basic needs. They're food insecure, they have a disproportionate number of health problems, they have poor shelter, they have very limited opportunities for their children. One of the things that's interesting, though, is that extreme poverty is being reduced. I mean, there's still 1.2 billion people, obviously, is way, way, way too many people.
Yeah.
But those numbers are going down. What concerns us at Trickle Up is the very poorest of those extreme poor. So probably the 200 to 400 million within that group, which are really not seeing very much change. And these are people who we call ultra-poor populations. And there's, I think there's a number of reasons why they're trapped in that level of poverty, which makes it so much more difficult to provide the right sorts of programs to help them move out, to improve their lives. And I think it's also worth pointing out that when we're talking about people living on a dollar a day or less, we need to remember that they don't have that amount every day. Sometimes they have more.
Sure.
Sometimes they have a lot less or none. And this is very much linked to what are called annual hungry seasons. These are the weeks or months before the harvest, but after the harvest from the previous year has been depleted, during which time, food insecurity, and these people are always food insecure, but it gets really, really dire and distressing. So during this time, people, often struggle to get one meal a day. Adults quite often forfeit meals altogether so that their children can eat. People really focus on filling their bellies to stave off hunger at the expense of more nutritious but expensive food, so they'll eat, just a lot of sort of carbohydrate. People would eat what's called bush food, so that's things they can collect from the environment, such as leaves and nuts. And really for the ultra-poor, getting enough food is a challenge year-round, but it's also a cyclical phenomenon where there are these times where life can get so bad that they also end up having to sell off what little assets that they have, which means that they're stuck in this cycle, which makes it very difficult for them to get out.
So even if at some points in the year they're able to make some money or accumulate something, there's always a season during the year where things get so hard that they end up having to squander away everything that they've earned just to be able to make it through the season.
That's correct.
So you mentioned it. I want to get back to some more of the food related aspects of your work. Maybe in a little bit after the break, but I want to get back to, you mentioned before sort of some of the particular tools that you as an organization are able to use to help begin to get these people out of extreme poverty. You mentioned some training and setting up businesses and savings group. I'm wondering if you could just get into all of those things that you do in a little more detail so we know the kind of work that you do.
Sure. Yeah, one of the first steps we do after we have, identified the poorest and spent a fair bit of time building their trust,
sure,
is integrate them into solidarity groups. Now, these also function as savings groups where people can together save and loan to each other. But because the poorest are generally very socially isolated and marginalized, it's also very important to bring them together with other people with whom, they can really start this journey. And as I say, as they start, bringing in some income, it means they can start saving, and very few of our participants have ever really saved anything before, and certainly not regularly. So, this is also a habit which they have, and doing that together really helps. And also make low-interest loans to each other and build social support, which, again, is really important for people who are living in such precarious circumstances. Then we provide training and livelihood planning, so really helping them think about what options they have, what activities they could bring, whether it's small business, vending activities, raising animals such as goats and chickens, investing in agriculture. And we really encourage people over time to develop a diversified portfolio, just as, you might in a pension fund or whatever. It reduces risk and it brings in more regular income for them. And once they have these plans in place, we give people grants
okay.
to start new livelihood activities. The size of them varies a bit from region to region. It's about from $100 in some places where we work to around $250.
Wow.
And they use those to really kickstart these activities, to invest in productive assets, you know, again, whether it's animals, some stock, to start a new business. Maybe if they, sometimes people have some, a little bit of land, but it's generally very poor quality, so they might grow a bit of land, a bit of food on it, but it's not nearly enough to feed the household, so we might help them improve that land through irrigation and the like. And then we provide what we call coaching or mentoring, where we have local local staff of our local partner organizations come and visit these households on a regular basis. And this is really important because most of our participants, because they don't have any productive assets, they've been mostly reliant on sporadic wage labor, you know, working on other people's land here and there.
Again, right.
They might grow a little bit of food, but not much. So it really is about transforming their livelihood strategies. And for that, they do need a lot of support. And again, they, you know, at first, they're still starting off as being quite vulnerable, and so there's lots of issues and problems that can come up. So these coaches and mentors do a lot of helping them troubleshoot, but also helping them really envisage a pathway out of poverty. That's one of the really awful things about being in poverty, is it's really difficult to see a pathway out of it.
Yeah, of course. All right, we are talking with Joe Sanson from Trickle Up. We need to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a moment. Stay with us.
Because I once had a love and now she's gone. Oh, don't you know she's gone? Oh, don't you know she's gone? And she ain't coming back. Laughing through the nights, crying through the days, losing my mind one tear at a time over you.
Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie. Gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
We are back. You are listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we have been talking with Joe Sanson from Trickle Up. Joe, I feel bad. I feel like we sort of cut you off pretty abruptly there going into the break. If you have anything more to explain to us about the various ways that you work with these women to start to bring them out of poverty, please continue, and if not, we can move on.
Sure. Yeah. No. I think, you know, I'd covered the main points, which is around, you know, this integration into the solidarity groups and savings groups, you know, training and livelihood planning, grants to start new businesses, and you know, productive activities and the coaching.
So how might say, you know, you just talked about before the break, we talked about the hungry season, the sort of the period of every year where you know, work is minimal and food is scarce. How would something like how would a savings group sort of help a group of women get through the hungry season better than they would on their own?
Yeah, good question. The savings groups are important financially because it allows people to, again, sort of build this habit of saving. And again, it's much, when you have very little money, it's very difficult to save, but doing it in a group helps build that discipline. And people use that savings partly to reinvest in productive activities so they can keep growing their livelihoods, growing their businesses, but, as you say, also in times of need. And these annual lean seasons, these hungry seasons, is a really important part. Now, one of the, you know, one of the ways, again, which people are trapped in poverty is that maybe, you know, maybe they've worked really, really, really hard and managed to buy a goat or something like that, thinking they might breed it, but then along comes the hungry season, run out of food, you're really forced to sell it at a time when prices are really low because everybody else is poor is selling it. So this means that instead you can draw on the savings which are in this savings group. So people take them out as loans. And a lot of people, you know, particularly in places like West Africa, you know, really plan for that saving, the lean season together. They think about strategies for how they're going to, you know, make sure they're saving enough to get through. So there's the financial side of it, which is critical, but then again, there's also the social side.
Yeah.
They're also building these, you know, these social interconnections, and, you know, they're sharing. There's a fair bit of, you know, helping each other, you know, especially if somebody has some problem, there's a sickness in the family, and people will go and, you know, bring food and and other types of support.
Does it ever get to the point where, you know, savings groups sort of build up enough capital in them that they can sort of buy large amounts of food? You mentioned the price fluctuation. You know, buy large amounts when the prices are favorable and somehow store them through the lean times?
Yes, absolutely. That's another important part of it. Again, particularly in West Africa, a lot of our savings groups invest in cereal banks to do exactly that. They build them. They're usually built out of mud. So they, you know, through their savings, they might pay some people in their village and do it themselves to build this cereal bank, which is basically sort of like this little hut where it's very well sealed from the elements and rodents and so on. And they will do exactly that. They will store some of their own grain, and they will buy other people's grain, and then they can have access to that during the lean season. And that's, again, one of the areas where we see it helping the community as a whole, because we've also seen these women coming together and understanding these are often the poorest people in the community, then helping others, providing others with lower-cost grain in times of need, which also really improves their
status
really great. Standing in the community.
I realize I sort of skipped over this at the beginning and took it sort of for a given, but can we talk for just a second about the organization's focus on women? You know, why are women particularly important players in the communities to be working with?
Sure. It's pretty well known in our field that if you help a woman to bring in income, she's likely to spend much more of it on meeting household needs than her husband. Of course, that's
interesting.
You know, not the case with everybody, but there's a lot of data to suggest that, and we certainly see it ourselves, whereas husbands often tend to feel a bit more sort of empowered to go off and spend it on themselves, whether, you know, with alcohol or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this means more of it goes to food and better nutritious food, and, of course, it's usually the women who are making decisions about food, and to their children. Again, making them be better nourished and better educated. So that's one part of it. The other is it's really important what a program like this can do for women's own status, confidence, and self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I just sort of mentioned in terms of the community, and we see this all the time in a place like India. You know, women, and it's difficult to believe, you know, you sort of go to these little communities and you think, you know, how could people not know each other and get along and so on? But some of these women saying, you know, now when I sort of walk down, you know, through the paths through the village, everybody says hello to me and they greet me and they treat me with respect.
Wow.
You know, and whereas before they wouldn't. And that's partly because they have savings, they have assets, often assets that other people can see, and also because they're part of a group, which brings a lot of status as well. And, you know, and then the other side of it is within the household. So one of the things we do is we measure, say, decision-making in the household. Who's making decisions about different things, issues of, you know, other things connected to status. Also, you know, domestic violence and so on really tends to go down when women have, you know, a better say and, you know, and also this social support among their peers.
You reminded me, I remember you touched in an email you sent to me a few days ago about the correlation between the lack of food and the lack of dignity, which I thought was a really interesting idea. And I think you've just mentioned a little bit about it, but can you talk a little bit about that idea? Like how, you know, how does having, you know, having money and having money to feed yourself and feed your family correspond to increased dignity, increased self-confidence, increased stature in the community?
Sure. I think sort of one of the most poignant examples I can think of is when we were in Mali a year or two ago and talking with a woman who had, invested in a vending business. She was selling vegetables and other things now in her own community, going out to the market and so on. And we were talking about, you know, the changes in her life. And she said, look, you know, one of the worst things about being really poor is the shame of it.
Yeah.
You know, which I would have thought, oh, God, you know, it's just sort of being poor and being hungry and so on. And she said, you know, when we didn't have enough to eat, we would still light a fire, and they did most of their cooking outdoors. We'd still light a fire and would put a pot of water on the fire to cook, even though we actually had no food to cook in it.
Wow.
Because we didn't want the neighbors to see that we didn't have any food.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, and we hear those stories quite often. I think another side of it was, and again, these are the sort of real nuances that often come through our, you know, the sort of more qualitative evaluation that you don't really necessarily expect, is people saying, you know, now we can host guests. you know, before people, you know, relatives might come from another village, and you'd never even be able to let them into your house because you don't have any food to give them. And so people would end up feeling quite socially isolated. They wouldn't be invited to weddings and other ceremonies because they wouldn't be able to contribute, and there's a real shame in not being able to contribute.
It's amazing. You'd think that, you know, like you said, with such small amounts of money, you'd think that the most basic hunger and survival things would be the biggest concerns. But there's obviously a lot more about their role within the community. You just mentioned some of the qualitative ways that you sort of monitor these people, but you know, you especially can speak to this as the director of monitoring and evaluation. How do you quantitatively, how do you look at these communities that you're working with and assess progress or lack of progress? What are the metrics that you use?
Sure. We use a variety of different tools. We use household surveys, which we use at baseline, at end of projects and follow-up, so we can look at, you know, changes in the household in terms of food security and a whole range of other different things. We do, you know, very close monitoring of our participants. Again, that's one of the, from my perspective, as being responsible for monitoring and evaluation, because we have these mentors and coaches visiting them regularly, they can really understand the dynamics of what's going on, what is helping people move ahead, what is hindering them as well, so we can address those things. So we have a lot of, you know, data that comes in quite regularly. And then the other side of it is, you know, these more qualitative evaluations, which you really need in order to be able to interpret the numbers that come through from the quantitative surveys. So through all these different surveys, you know, we collect data on a whole range of different indicators. Some of the food-related ones include, you know, what types of food people eat, you know, particularly looking at things like protein, are people eating, you know, legumes, even meat occasionally, mm-hmm. dairy and so on, and what we've seen in Guatemala, that's doubled, you know, between the beginning and the end of the project. Instances of missing meals and missing food. We also look at, you know, how many meals people eat per day, and I soon sort of realize, okay, actually defining what a meal is pretty complicated in these circumstances.
Yeah, so how do you do that?
It's all very culturally specific. So in India, when we're talking with these women about this, you know, when times are really hard, really what they have is rice water, which is the water that's left over from cooking rice the day before. So, you know, that is a meal of sorts for them, but it's certainly not very filling. It's just enough to sort of keep them going a little bit working in the fields.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we really have to sort of differentiate a lot between, you know, what is a meal, what isn't. In Guatemala, you know, they might be able to have one cooked meal a day, you know, and that's not bad, but then the other meals might be eating tortillas with some salt. So there is a lot of nuance there that we do need to take into account. We also look at coping mechanisms. So what do people end up doing, especially during these hungry seasons when they run out of food? And we make a distinction between reversible and irreversible coping mechanisms. So
okay.
Getting deeply into debt to moneylenders is something, you know, which is much closer to the irreversible because, again, it's trapping you in this cycle of, you know, paying high interest. And, you know, that's one of the areas we've found a big change, whereas at the start of the program, 72% of our participants were in debt to moneylenders for food, and at the end of the program, that's down to 2%. And that's, you know, again, a mixture of one, having more income coming in through their own activities and more food coming in, which they're growing directly, but also being able to rely on their savings group instead.
Right. So you've talked about a bunch of ways that you sort of evaluate success. Do you have any examples of, you know, times when you've analyzed it and you've seen things that weren't quite working and you made changes, you made fixes to address them? Like, how do you, you know, how do you keep your work dynamic and ever-changing with the, you know, the needs of the people that you're working with?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's the real purpose of our monitoring and evaluation is to see what's working and to keep doing more of it and to see what's not working so we can change. I think one of the issues that we saw when we were analyzing all of our data from India last year was that some types of livelihood activities seem to be more successful than others.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, you know, and that does vary a bit from place to place. And so that has led us to modify a little bit what types of activities we are encouraging participants to do. Now, of course, it's always a participant's own decision to engage in an activity. If it's not, then they're not really going to have the buy-in and it's not going to work out very well. But it's really the whole very careful facilitation process that we go through. And, you know, this is based on our own market studies of what types of activities work and which ones don't.
Yeah.
Another thing we found was that in certain areas, again, sort of connected to choice of livelihood activities, people who had invested in goats, goat rearing, weren't reaching the targets that we had hoped for as much as other people. And we found that this was partly because there were some issues with the care of goats. Say in the wet season, you've got to make sure that the, you know, goats, their feet aren't touching the ground, so they're on raised platforms
right.
and so on. Otherwise, they get foot rot or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sure.
So that really, even though, you know, we'd already trained all of our local staff on those issues, we did a lot of refresher training to really make sure that they were looking into these issues.
Okay, we are just about out of time, but I want to give you one final minute or two or whatever it is to both let people know, you know, you are an organization that can certainly benefit from any contributions from people that they might be willing to give. So both to let people know where they might be able to do that and find out more about Trickle Up, but also just to, you know, give sort of briefly some encapsulation of why the work you're doing is sort of different from other microfinance or other larger scale aid organizations that might be doing similar work. But if you want to make a pitch, you can make a pitch, or else just let us know where we can help out if we're so inclined.
Great, thank you. Yes, well, you know, I think Trickle Up, you know, has a very specific niche on reaching the poorest of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things we've really learned, you know, as an organization over these years is you need specific skills and expertise to reach that population. You know, so I think there's a lot of, you know, good organizations out there doing good work.
Yep.
But, you know, if you really want to reach the poorest of the poor, then, you know, you do need to have a specific, you know, and well-tested approach to do that. And, you know, and again, I think for various reasons there's a very strong argument for trying to reach those people because, you know, they are the neediest and they are the ones most overlooked.
Very well put.
Thank you. And certainly we absolutely, well, we live off the contributions of people,
sure.
Probably like the listeners on this program. So that's a really important part for us. So you can visit our website, which is www.trickleup.org. That's TRICKLEUP.ORG. On our website, there's also a donate page. So if you go to trickleup.org/donate, you can also like us on Facebook. Again, we're going to Trickle Up. Follow us on Twitter. At Trickle Up NYC, that's TRICKLEUPNYC. And you could also volunteer with us by joining our Young Professionals Council, which is a dedicated group of young professional volunteers in New York City raising awareness about Trickle Up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes, no, we'd love, you know, we've got a wonderful bunch of supporters, and they get to, you know, I think hear a lot more of the sort of juicy details about our work as well, which is great.
And there's information about that on the website?
That's right. I'll give you, it's a slightly different website, so that's, I mean, there is a link to it on our main website.
Okay.
You can also go to it's Trickle Up YPC, so that's TRICKLEUPYPC.ORG.
Okay, fantastic. Wow, lots of ways to connect, and I bet if we all, I don't know, if we all pitched in and gave $1.25 a day to you guys, you could probably do wonders with it.
Yeah, or even a little more, yes.
Even a little more, very good. Joe, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today and quite eye-opening to have you here. Thank you so much, I really appreciate it. You've been listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Don't you know she's gone, and she ain't coming back.